Be interesting.
We do not have a quorum, but I'm going to start the testimony from the Department of Health, and we have here Dr. Ellinger. Do you want to come up to the table? Welcome to the committee, Dr. Hey, Ellinger.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health. I'm here with Abigail Reed, our Chief Financial Officer, and we have lots of staff in the audience to be at your beck and call if you have questions that we can't answer as we go through our budget presentation. And I'm going to give a few opening comments to set the context for how we put our budget together, sort of the principles behind what we're trying to accomplish with the budget proposal that we've worked on with the governor and the governor's office. And then Ms. Reed will go through some of the details of this. So let me start with the first slide that really shows, makes the point that public health is really an investment. I've been in healthcare for 40-some years and found out very shortly after starting practice that I could be seeing patients every day, every year, seeing lots of patients, and it may impact that individuals, but without a strong public health infrastructure, wouldn't have the really kind of impact that I would like to have in the community. And so really dedicated a lot of my efforts to talking about public health and building a public health system, because it is an investment in our future. It's an investment in today, but it's an investment in the future. It's an investment in the mothers and babies that really are healthy and give healthy births, and certainly low birth weight babies are a real risk factor to our long-term health. It's an investment in our elderly to make sure that our nursing homes and hospitals and long-term care facilities and home care programs are safe and healthy, so that our seniors have a chance to remain healthy as long as possible. It's an investment in the safety of our communities, so that the emergency preparedness, we're there when there's floods, when there's tornadoes, when there are water main breaks, that we can respond quickly and protect. We're there to have the infrastructure to identify infectious diseases and a whole variety of things that we do. It's that investment that really has an impact both in the short term, but particularly in the long term. So we always look at our budget as really an investment in the long-term health of Minnesota.
And Dr. Ellinger, I just have to ask, since I live in Kellogg Square and they shut down our water because of the water main, and did the Department of Health have to authorize them to turn it back on? I mean, you looked at the flood, I think, your people.
Yeah, we were actively involved in making decisions about the water, and the fact that once the water main break occurred, it had a risk of contamination, so we issued the boil order. And then worked with the St. Paul Water Department when it got back up to give the instructions on how best to do that to maintain safety and stop the boil order. So we were actively involved in that process.
Thank you.
And that's a good example, I think, of the partnership also that we are at. We are in partnership with people throughout the state, with local communities, with counties, with cities, with the mayor of St. Paul, and with local public health. It is a partnership that we really value, and I think adds strength to what happens in public health. We have a strong state health department, and we have a strong local public health system, and it's that partnership that really helps make Minnesota healthy. But I want to point out this slide, which really focuses on the longevity over the last 100 years in the United States. And we've increased our longevity by about 30 years over the last 100 years. And I know I was pleased to note that the governor in his State of the State address mentioned longevity as one of the issues that he highlighted, that we are the second longest living population in the country. We have the second highest length of life. And among males, we have the highest length of life. And it's because of, I think, a lot of the things that go on in Minnesota, the investments that we've made in public health. But this slide in particular points out the fact that the first 50 years of the sort of the last 100, you see a jagged edge, because that's as the longevity was really dependent a lot on acute diseases, particularly infectious diseases. poor sanitation, poor infected food supplies and water supplies, and in broad-based infectious disease outbreaks. And so we responded when an outbreak occurred, and we developed systems to do that. And over the 50 years, first 50 years, we developed a lot of ways to deal with that in terms of sanitation and making safe food and water supplies and vaccinations and surveillance. And we've been able to really get on top of that. That doesn't mean that those infectious diseases have gone away. It's just that we are controlling them with a lot of the health protection activities that we do in the health department and health departments throughout the state. The last half of the 20th century, you see the line kind of flattened out because, you know, we got rid of a lot of, or we controlled a lot of the infectious diseases, but the leading causes of death really became much more chronic in terms of diabetes and heart disease and cancer and stroke. And those things are don't come in epidemics in terms of acute epidemics. They're sort of long-term epidemics. And we've not had the same kind of intervention in those chronic diseases as we've had with the acute diseases. And you'll see in our budget, what we're trying to do is actually have an investment in that. We want to maintain the two parts of our budget, the two parts of our activities that we think are really important. One is the health protection, the infrastructure that's there to keep infectious diseases under control, to keep injuries under control, to keep foodborne outbreaks under control. That's the health protection piece. But we also want the health improvement piece, which we see as the immunizations of the current climate, where they're the immunizations against diabetes and obesity and heart disease. And these are the things like the SHIP program, where we're really looking at community-oriented prevention, some of the policies changes, some of the system changes, some of the environmental changes. And so we're going to be talking to you about some of those investments to maintain the infrastructure, the health protection things, but also to make an investment in health improvement, which we see really is going to impact our health, our longevity, and our costs. And the next slide shows that relationship in our country between costs and longevity. Longevity, this slide shows as on the x-axis, the bottom line, the amount of dollars spent per person per year on healthcare, and on the y-axis, the vertical axis, is life expectancy. And you can see the United States far on the right, where we spend much more money than any other country in the world on healthcare, and yet our life expectancy, although high, is not the highest in the world. There are many countries who are higher than we are. And it shows that it's not the money that's being spent, but I think it's how the money is being spent. We're not getting the biggest bang for the dollars because, as the next slide shows, we invest more of our overall dollars on medical care than on some of the public health and social service activities that really have a huge impact. This slide shows the total investments of countries on health and human services. The dark line is the investment on medical care, and the gray line is the investment in public health and social service. And you can see in this slide that the United States doesn't spend more the most in the world on health and human services. We spend the most on medical care. We're sort of in the middle of the pack on health and human services. And the point that I really want to make with this slide is that what we do is out of balance with some of the countries that have a much better outcome. They know how to balance better the medical care, the public health, and the social services, all of which are necessary to really be a healthy community, a healthy nation.
Commissioner, the gray lines here, does that include long-term care?
I believe that it does, Mr. Chair. And only two other countries on this chart actually spend more than 50% of their total health and human services dollars on medical care, and that's down at the bottom, Korea and Mexico, where they only spend a total of 12% of their total GDP on health and human services. Certainly, we're not arguing that we would reduce our total investment in health and human services to that level. We want to, you know, I think we have a good investment in health and human services. We would just like to rebalance that a little bit. Next slide. And we want to rebalance that because the data are showing on the left side of this, it shows what are the determinants of health, what really contributes to health in our world. And on the left, you can see that access to health care is incredibly important, but it really impacts really only about 10% of our overall health, our overall morbidity and mortality. The other 90% is really made up of our genetics, our environment, healthy behaviors, social circumstances that actually impact a lot on the health behaviors. And that contrasts with where we actually spend our money. And on the right side, it shows currently where we in the United States spend our health care dollar or our total health investment in health. And 88% of that goes to medical services, despite the fact that only about 10% of our total determinants of health are health is determined by access to care. The other, only about 4% are really on behaviors and focus on behaviors. That's where we think that we need to really change the balance. We need to reinvest in public health. And this slide shows that I believe that we need to have a balanced investment. This slide shows the annual health care costs that we would have if we had just universal access to health care on its own. That's the red line. And you can see if everybody had access to medical care, you could see our costs go up. The blue line is that if you had medical care and you added preventive services, what would happen to costs? You'd save more lives, but the costs would go up. The green line is if everybody had access to medical care and had preventive care within the clinic setting, and you did the community prevention services, the environmental health issues, the change in policy, system, and environment, added that to the package, you could see what's going to happen with costs. The data are showing that the only way that we're really going to get ahead of the curve on terms of costs is if we focus our efforts on the community prevention, the tobacco cessation activities, the physical activity cessation or improvement activities, work on obesity, work on improving nutrition. Those are the things that really are necessary if we're going to really improve our health and save costs. The issue, though, is that these are long-term investments. These things don't happen overnight. Chronic diseases like diabetes, heart disease, stroke, are chronic, meaning that they're long-acting. They take a long time to develop. They take a long time to turn the curve. Our investments in healthy behaviors, healthy environments, healthy policies are going to be an investment that we have to make now to see the benefit down the road.
Representative Liebling has a question or a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, if I don't know how much time you have here and whether we have really time to explore some of these.
Well, we're going to go the whole hour and a half here, and then tomorrow we're going to have public testimony. Okay. So I think you can answer the question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Ellinger, sorry to interrupt you here. I was back on the, I had actually had a couple of things, but I was intrigued by your chart on page 6, the one that shows how much, what the determinants of health are and what the expenditures are. And as I was looking at this, and of course it's not a new concept, but I'm looking at the chart, I noticed the social circumstances, 15% of the determinants. And then there's nothing on the spending side. And I realize this is a bit out of your bucket of things because the social circumstances. But I wondered what might be included in that, and if the things that are included in that are things like housing, for example, and access to employment and things like that, we certainly do spend money on those things here in the legislature, not in your budget mainly, but certainly in the budget that we oversee here, and I'm just wondering kind of where that fits in. I know you probably didn't draw this chart, but I just wondered if you could comment on that. That's one of my questions. And then the second question is really if you could just explain a little bit more when we use the term life expectancy. I've probably even asked this before in this committee, but life expectancy is kind of widely misunderstood as a term. And I wonder if you could just give us a little primer on what's meant by that, because I think people tend to misunderstand. You know, if a life expectancy is 80, does that mean that I'm going to live to 80 kind of thing?
Dr. Ellinger.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, let me answer your first question. It's an excellent observation in terms of the social circumstances. The social circumstances include a lot of things that we've been identifying as sort of the social determinants of health, the things that influence people's health, educational level, economic level, employment, neighborhood safety, housing, transportation, access to food. These are things that are some of the social determinants of health. They're not, the investments in this chart are really not highlighted. They look at mostly just the Health and Human Services investments in this. And as we understand that there's health in all policies, your question is an excellent one in that we have to think about this more broadly. And as I talked about partnerships, our partners in creating health are not just local public health agencies and hospitals and clinics. Our partners are Department of Education and school districts throughout the state. Our partners are the business community. Our partners are transportation. Our partners are the housing and employment development, all of those activities. So we need to look at that broadly as where we're going to make some of our investment. But we have not identified, and there are ways that the medical community and the public health community can actually influence some of the social determinants as we look particularly at the SHIP program, for example, which how do we bring food into a community? How do we change the environment of the food so that there are safe walking and biking paths? There's complete streets. Those are some of the social determinants that we are investing in these areas, those are the places where we do have some control. The other point related to life expectancy is how long will somebody live on the day that they are born? If somebody born today, can we predict for an entire population that the average length of life would be? At this point in time, it's for men it's 79.3 years, and for women in Minnesota it's 83.3 years. That a baby born today, a male infant, can be expected to live 79.3 years. Certainly, it changes. There's also life expectancy once you reach the age of 60. You can recalculate that because you've gotten through some of the infant mortality issues where we lose a lot of years of life because a baby, that dies early on, that takes a lot of years away. And so child mortality is also an issue. So that's why we've had some really huge impacts in longevity, because we've lowered infant mortality. We've lowered child mortality. We've lowered a lot of occupational mortality, where people early on in their working years have not been injured and killed in work-related incidents. So that's some of the things that have really increased our longevity.
Thank you.
Representative Gernhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Ellinger, Commissioner Ellinger, for your doctor and commission. Okay, Commissioner. Two titles. All right. I've been in the health insurance industry for about 30 some years. So I've seen some of these charts on the impact of healthcare dollars. And when you read some additional commentary, one of the reasons for the disparity as far as the United States spending versus life expectancy that get brought out is, one, we do more for preborn children, in terms of medical development, than most other countries do. In other words, a preborn child at 5 months probably dies in a lot of countries. Here we spend the money to keep as many of them alive as possible. Also, we spend more on the innovation side. We're the innovative leader in the world, according to articles I've read, as far as medical technology. That also drives our costs. A lot of these other companies just copy or take from us, so that keeps their costs down, whether it's in drugs or medical device technology. And the third area that skews these numbers that I've read is the amount we spend on the elderly at some time. In other words, according to the articles I've read, about 80% of your health care costs are going to be in the last 2 years of your life, and on average. So when you factor in those three things, it gives a rationale, and you've touched on it briefly with the early or premature birth comments. That's why the United States actually, if you factor those out, we have a longer life expectancy based on our spending. When you factor them in, that's what skews the numbers. Would you care to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gernhagen, I believe we do have this is my personal bias, I believe we have the best medical care system in the world, in Minnesota. I think we have the highest quality, we have some of the best access, the lowest cost. And I think that it's a feather in our cap for doing that. But despite that, we have not maximized the impact that we can have on health. We spend money, and we do have a lot of innovations that I think are really important that have helped us out. But I think we could even do better with having this best medical care system if we would reduce, through prevention activities, some of the low birth weight babies. We could save some of those dollars and have really a bigger impact. If we could keep the elderly healthy so that we wouldn't have as many problems at the end of life, because the data are showing that if you can keep elderly healthy longer, the costs at the end of life care really go down dramatically. So I think it's a matter of we need to maintain our great medical care system. We want to enhance it, and we're doing a lot of work on trying to improve that. And we need to balance it with the prevention aspect. We want to have a balanced portfolio if we're really going to have a healthy state. There are certainly lots of ways that you can compare folks, and you can use the data. But I'm just pointing out the fact that we spend a lot of money. We don't have the best, you know, from one indicator, life expectancy. But you can also find other infant mortality and other things. But they shouldn't be the sole criteria. It is, what do we want as a state? How can we be healthiest? And I think if we balance our investment in treatment and prevention, we will have the best outcomes, and we'll save the most money, the best quality, and have the population that has the best experience in this state.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gronhagen.
Oh, thank you for those comments, Commissioner, and I agree with you. It's, you know, people can put different perspectives on the same information, and I guess I was just sharing that to balance out, you know, some of the comments, that there are different reasons why we see this type of a line in there, and I appreciate your comments. You know, the other thing, if you can ever do anything, I think one of the major drivers of healthcare inflation is that our FDA has become a dinosaur of bureaucracy and drives up the cost of medical device approval exponentially and the cost of our drugs exponentially. So to the degree that you can reform that federal agency, I would sincerely appreciate it.
Get right on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gronhagen, yes, I will be meeting with Commissioner Hamburg, Margaret Hamburg, the FDA chair, in a couple of weeks, and I'll pass along your comments. But those devices are sort of out of the area that I work on. But my area is saying, all right, what are the real drivers? And certainly the cost of medical devices is one piece, but what's the cost of obesity in our society? What's the cost of tobacco use? What's the cost of physical inactivity? These are huge costs that we have, and we haven't really put enough effort on trying to reduce those. If we could reduce obesity by even 1% in this country, we would save billions of dollars in medical costs, but it would also improve our economic development in terms of productivity and being able to work. So I think we need to have a balanced approach, and that's where we're really, you know, making the statement that we have to invest in prevention, and we have to invest in health protection and invest in health improvement.
Mr. Chair, just one quick follow-up comment.
We got to move on.
Okay, you know, if you're going to quote me to the FDA, use the word fossilized dinosaur. Okay, that's the way I see it. Thank you,
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gronhagen. I wouldn't call you a fossilized dinosaur.
No, not me. The FDA.
I just want to put a quick plug. I really appreciate the commissioner's comments, and we do have a task force or a work group, if you will, on childhood obesity, and we hear testimony. We've been hearing testimony for years on that very issue, so if any of you have interest in that, please come talk to me later. On both sides of the aisle, it's a bipartisan committee with Representative Detmer co-chairing, and we'll get you in the loop.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that you know, with that slide showing that we need to have a balanced approach. I want universal access to health care. I want to have prevention included as part of medical care, and I want to have us as a state really invest in the community prevention, because I think it's a balanced package that makes the clinicians more successful. It makes our public health folks more successful. It makes our state more successful, because if we don't have health, We don't have anything that really works well in the state, and this is the best way to get at that. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to our Abigail Reed, our Chief Financial Officer, to go through the articulating the kind of investments that we're making, the things that we've discussed with the governor, and that we're in agreement really need to move forward on making Minnesota the healthiest state it can possibly be. Ms. Reed?
Mr. Chair and members, can you hear me? For the record, my name is Abigail Reed. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Health. And I'm going to start with this slide here, just give you an overview of what the governor has recommended for the Department of Health in the 14-15 biennial budget. And what this shows is that the governor has recommended a total of about $59 million in spending, new spending changes. And if you see that broken down, really the majority of that is the SHIP program, the statewide health improvement program that the commissioner talked about. And as you recall, this is actually, even though it looks like all new money, you recall that it was originally funded at $47 million in the first biennial. It was created, which was 10 and 11, and then it was funded at $15 million in the second biennium, the current one we're in, and so the recommendation here is to restore it to statewide status, truly statewide, at $40 million. And then next, about $9.5 million is changes to our regulatory and screening programs, so that's mostly home health care regulation and the newborn screening program, which we'll talk about. There's another $7.7 million in clean water fund appropriations. I don't believe those are under the jurisdiction of this committee, but wanted to point them out here. And then there's another $2 million in a general fund investment for core public health. This is really looking at some addressing some federal cuts we've had and other cuts over the years and a few critical threats to our public health infrastructure. That total amount is offset by a small amount of rent savings related to the closure of one of our facilities and also about $9.4 million in total revenue changes. And those are mostly related fees related to those screening and regulatory programs. So the net change overall is the $49.6 million you'll see recommended in the governor's budget. And we're not going to work from the governor's documents today, but if you are looking for the change items that we're covering, they're on pages 6 through 10 or 11, I believe, of the governor's budget document for the Department of Health. And so what we were going to work from actually today is a series of fact sheets, about one-pagers on each item, and I believe those were included in your packet. They probably start with a page that looks like this and then go into pages like this. And so we'll work from those, and what they really provide is kind of an overview of the background, the rationale, and a high-level description of the proposal, and we'll hit some of the details as we walk through. As the commissioner mentioned, we're certainly not the two of us experts in everything, but we do have some experts in the audience, so don't be surprised if we phone a friend if you ask a more detailed question. And, of course, if we don't have the information for you today, we can certainly get it back to you quickly, or we're happy to come back and talk about specific proposals later, meet with members, whatever works for you. We're here to make sure you have the information you need to make some good decisions. So I'm going to, if I recall how to do this, turn this on. Yes. Okay. So the first fact sheet focuses on the SHIP program. That's the Statewide Health Improvement Program. I know the committee is familiar with it, but wanted to just spend a little time as a reminder. It is a national model. It uses sustainable approaches and proven strategies that really tackle, as the commissioner said, those leading causes of death and disease in our country and in the world right now, obesity, tobacco use, and physical activity inactivity. And I know you've heard the statistics before, but they certainly bear repeating. Nearly two-thirds of Minnesotans are overweight or obese. Childhood obesity, as Representative Norton mentioned, has tripled in 30 years. It's really a problem that's been created in one generation. Chronic disease is estimated to cause 35% of deaths and 75% of healthcare spending in the United States. Even kind of in Minnesota, where we're above average, we still spend $2.8 billion on tobacco-related healthcare costs and $2.9 billion in economic costs related to obesity. And as you heard earlier, these chronic diseases like diabetes, stroke, heart disease, and cancer, they're really kind of our threats for the future. We've spent a lot and invested a lot over the years in tackling infectious diseases, and we often could have a shot or some sort of immunization or some sort of public health infrastructure to tackle that. These are our new problems, and this is the approach to tackle those. Unfortunately, they can't be cured with a shot. But fortunately, we do know what the cure is, and that's things like good nutrition, exercise, avoiding tobacco use, and excessive alcohol use. And so what the SHIP program does is it provides grants to community health boards and tribes who, in partnership with community leadership teams that they form, they choose from a menu of proven strategies to create the policy, environmental, and systems change that supports healthier choices. So instead of telling people to exercise more, the grantees work with city planners or others to create more walking paths. Instead of just telling kids to eat healthier, which we know doesn't work so well, usually grantees get local farm produce into schools and work on other ways, reducing sugary beverages from classrooms or from schools, those sorts of things, to actually kind of make the healthier choice the easy choice. Some of the biggest advocates for the program are actually businesses who've implemented worksite wellness programs in partnership with SHIP. Because what they find is they really achieve two objectives. They are supporting their employees better, and they have happier employees. They're also reducing their health care costs. So to ensure we're getting the most for that SHIP dollar that we're spending, we also, as part of the program, provide a lot of technical assistance to those counties and tribes to make sure that they are designing and implementing those strategies effectively. And while, as the commissioner said, success is better measured in the long term, there is a robust evaluation component to make sure that as we are creating these changes in our communities, we're measuring that impact and can report back on that. This is funded out of the Healthcare Access Fund, and the majority goes to grants, but as I said, there's some portion of it that goes to technical assistance and the grants management and oversight piece. And really, the way I think about this program is kind of the problems of obesity and diabetes, tobacco use, alcohol, they're really bigger than government can tackle alone. And that's really what this program does, is it kind of leverages those public-private partnerships to make sure we're making the changes in our environments, the places we live and learn and work and go to the doctor every day to make them healthier. And that really creates a multiplier effect on public dollars that you couldn't get in a lot of other ways.
I would just say there was a wonderful article in yesterday's Minneapolis newspaper about this kind of program in the city of New Ulm. And I will have that reproduced and hand it out. But they basically, the whole community has bought into this, including the Chamber of Commerce, to help small businesses. And the one that got me, the restaurants were a little concerned about healthy eating, but they're now getting to the point where that's the kind of food people want. So just within one little community, it's not just the public health, it's not just the healthcare providers, but the whole community has bought into this, and it's almost worth a trip to New Ulm to see it. Yes. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just on that note, I had a little conversation last night with the gentleman who runs the concession outside in the Capitol when we're there late at night. And he tells me that there just isn't a market for healthy food. And so since we're the health committee folks, I think we should... let's exert a little market pressure. Maybe SHIP can help us, I don't know, to get some healthy food when we're there late at night so that members can stay away from the junk food. And no, he swears that people, when they're up late, they want those carbohydrates. And, you know, there's a lot of candy for sale and no fruit, so that's because of demand. Just saying.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abrams.
Oh, to that point, I remember seeing a little before I got here that I saw something on TV about what legislators eat, and they were doing hot dogs and pop and blaming that on the poor quality legislating that happened at that point. So before I got here, so it couldn't have been us. But so how can you make a good law living on hot dogs and mustard and stuff?
Mr. Chair, members, does indicate we have a long way to go. I was going to turn, Mr. Chair, to the next item unless there are any more questions on that one.
Go ahead.
The next item in your packet is the Core Public Health Initiative. As I mentioned before, this initiative invests about $2 million from the general fund to address four critical threats to our public health infrastructure. And I know we've used that word a couple times, infrastructure, very ubiquitous government word. But it really does describe what we do well. We have this sort of system of partnerships and effort behind the scenes to make sure that when bad things happen, or we can prevent bad things from happening, or when they do happen, to restore order quickly. And so I was joking before that we have a new communications director, and he has kind of a tough job, because when we do our job well, you don't always see it. And so he has to do a lot of work to kind of highlight the good work of public health. But we have some of our local partners here today, too, and we work very closely together. And it's a real system with a lot of interlocking parts. And so as you start to pull pieces out, like a little bit of federal funding there, a little bit of state funding here, you can really have a cumulative effect that's very hard on our total system. And so what this does is look at four places where we've had some of those pieces pulled out, and without restoring some of them or looking at a state investment in them, we will be challenged to maintain that infrastructure. And so the first item in there is the relates to our lead poisoning prevention program. And this program that we have at our department is actually a foundation that serves a number of agencies, state and local, that together prevent and respond to childhood lead poisoning and also in adults as well. And that we leverage across all those agencies a number of federal grants, and one of those was reduced in the past year. And that's one that came to us that we've received since 1994, and it supports a number of statutory requirements at our department, including identifying children who've been exposed to high blood levels, to lead, and where we also respond with education, medical case management, and other outreach services. We also collect a lot of data that we provide to other organizations like the Medical Assistance Program at DHS, the health plans, Head Start. So it is a number of requirements that we've traditionally paid for with that federal money, but with that federal money removed, the problem still remains. In 2011, for example, over 3,000 Minnesota children under the age of 6 were reported to have blood lead levels higher than the federal guidelines, the current guideline, and without intervention, those children would be at risk for things like learning disabilities, behavioral problems, and at extremely high levels, more life-threatening problems. And so what this would do, it doesn't restore all of the money that we've lost, but it does provide $100,000 per year to support one of our current staff who would do data collection, connecting people to those outreach services, and some of the primary prevention work. And since it only partially offsets those funds, we're still looking at other strategies to balance our core activities with the outreach that's done to follow up with those children.
Representative Norton has a question.
Thank you. More of a comment, and I very much support this. In fact, someone in the hall the other day told me there's been a correlation over time with reducing lead and decrease in violent crimes, and I don't know if that's true or not, but I suspect there may be a relationship there. I want to throw something in here that sort of links with this and then back into the rest of the packet. The Star Tribune, as Representative Huntley mentioned, had a number of articles that were interesting in the last few days, and one of them was a couple pages on radon. And I know radon mitigation and federal funding is in jeopardy, and the state, the department has a nice website, and they do the annual January Radon Day. But in reading that article, it reminded me that for very little money, the home I think they talked about in the paper this weekend was about $1,300 or something to do the mitigation system. That home is forever radon free if it's maintained, and it's a one-time investment. And if we could get 30 or 40 or 100,000 homes that have high radon fixed once and for all, with grants to families to help if they need assistance, we could make a huge headway, not just in reducing the radon, but the health impacts. It's the leading cause of lung cancer, next to second, cigarettes in the state and in the country. And we're a very high radon state. So I was a little disappointed to not see that there. And I just guess I would just, maybe it requires that I write a bill and carry it through, which I certainly can do. But I just, kind of raise that issue. It is a huge concern. We've got new homes that are now going to be radon free, but the old homes need help and the families need help doing something. And I just think the return on investment for $1,000 a home might be worth considering either now or in the future. So I just throw that out there as we go through these next, millions of dollars of requests. That one you might want to think about, or I'd appreciate it if you'd think about it.
Okay. Ms. Reed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, we do have, as you said, a program that's a sort of a voluntary program that helps educate, and we'd be happy to talk with you further about what your interest is. Moving on to the next item, it's actually for our infectious disease lab. And while this is one item in the governor's budget, I should have mentioned, we did do four separate fact sheets, so you can get in a little deeper on each component of it. So the next fact sheet looks at our infectious disease lab, and this provides $200,000 per year for the infectious disease lab. This is one of two proposals you'll see in this package that really aims to stabilize our lab funding. There's been a steady decline in funding for our lab over a number of years, and that really threatens our ability to rapidly and accurately detect as well as respond to emerging disease threats. And so what this money would do is support two existing staff in the lab, also the testing supplies, some IT support, and maintenance of the high-tech equipment that we use for the lab testing. And most of the testing is in the area of foodborne disease, tuberculosis, rabies, and STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. And the IT money actually will help us cut the reporting time from reporting time by 1 to 2 days, which will allow us to respond more quickly to those infectious disease outbreaks when we detect them. And just to give you a sense of kind of how our lab is funded and why this is important, we do have federal grants that are typically focused on specific programs or issues. We also have a number of paying customers for particular tests, but really there's that foundation of state support that's necessary to maintain the capacity that allows us to attract that money, and also to do some of the infectious disease work that you can't really charge for. We actually have a state law that requires providers to send us samples and specimens of certain suspected infectious diseases. And that's where we can test them. We can take quick action as a state to prevent those outbreaks, if they are indeed outbreaks, from spreading further. And we don't want to have a financial disincentive for providers to voluntarily participate because they're required in that program. And so it's important to maintain enough capacity in the lab to handle that. And this funding will allow us help us to do that. So the next item is actually the cancer reporting system. This is $350,000 per year to replace a 25-year-old database. It's one that we use to monitor the occurrence of cancer in Minnesota, to describe the risks of developing cancer, inform health professionals, and educate Minnesotans regarding the risks of cancer. We also use it to answer Minnesotans' questions and concerns, and that's probably the most high-profile aspect of that work. And then we also promote research and guide decisions about how to target cancer control resources. So you can see from that list, this database is really essential to understanding the problems and making sure that we kind of take the highest value and most effective forms of control. And it's really extremely challenging to replace, not surprising, since it's 25 years old. We have to track a vast amount of information and also protect data privacy, make sure we're meeting a variety of state and federal guidelines. So these funds would actually support a public health scientist to kind of guide the design of that system, and then also pay for the implementation of the system. And it's really important to do this now because the current system is so old, we actually have few people who can maintain it. And it also really isn't flexible enough to manage the changes in the healthcare industry, changes in public's demand for information and how we collect it, and also to really adapt as our knowledge of cancer changes. So that's why it's very important to do this now. And the fourth item in this package is another $350,000 per year that would, again, support existing staff. These are folks out in our district offices. We have 8 district offices around the state. They are in Bemidji, Duluth, Fergus Falls, St. Cloud, Marshall, Mankato, and Rochester. And the folks out in those offices, there are public health nurses, emergency preparedness coordinators, and epidemiologists who provide specialized expertise in support of the local public health departments. And so we really have a federated system, as the commissioner said, a partnership for delivering public health in the state. We serve as the lead agency, and the local health departments actually deliver many of the services based on their deep knowledge of the community needs and the local conditions, needs, and resources. And so Again, we are in a situation where the federal government is reducing the funds we have used traditionally pay for a portion of these staff. We actually group a number of different federal funding streams plus some state funds into the funding that we use to support this total program. And again, one piece is being pulled out, and so we need to shore that up to make sure we can continue that service. And so this would support a portion of the 3.25 existing staff. And really, this is important. It is the primary way that we ensure all Minnesotans have access to those world-class public health services, regardless of location in the state. And it also helps make sure we don't have to recreate that specialized expertise at each local public health department around the state. We can do that once centrally and support a broader range. They can focus their resources on meeting those specific community needs. And as the commissioner has traveled around the state, he's heard a lot of feedback from local governments saying that this is a really important service that the state provides to them. So we want to make sure we can maintain it.
If I could just interrupt, we now have a quorum. And so I would call the meeting to order. And would somebody like to move the February 7th minutes?
So moved.
Of the Any discussion? I don't see any, so all those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the minutes are approved, and we'll go back now to the Department of Health.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to move next to the newborn screening item. And so this item...
Representative Newton has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just flipping through here to look... for in the department, where do we find efforts in the part of suicide prevention? We've got evidently increasing rates of suicide. Is that within the Department of Health? Is it under like the SHIP program or the CORE program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newton.
Mr. Commissioner.
The suicide prevention is part of our activities, but also part of what the Department of Human Services does with their mental health program. We have identified some of those activities as part of our injury prevention activities, so we partner closely with the Department of Human Services. They've got things in their budget that are actually focused on that I think you will be hearing about in terms of some of the mental health initiatives, but we partner closely with them to try to make sure that we address this major public health issue collaboratively.
Thank you. Continue.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I'm moving to the newborn screening item, and this strengthens our newborn screening program. It adds two new tests. It increases the educational outreach we can do and also fixes a structural deficit in the fee account that supports the program that has been caused by rising costs and also declining birth rates in the state. So what this would do is increase the appropriation for the program by $2.2 million per year, and it adds those two new tests, which have been recommended by the federal government and the state advisory committee that's set up in statute to advise the commissioner on when to add new tests. And the first of those is called SCID, or Severe Combined Immune Deficiency. It's often called the bubble boy disease, and it's a group of conditions, actually, that are they cause severe inability of the immune system to fight infection, which leads to chronic health problems or even death in some cases. So long-term survival for children treated before 3 months is actually 95%, but without the screening, diagnosis is almost always delayed, which leads to worse health outcomes and tremendously more expensive care. So, for example, the average care for a child who's diagnosed later is $2.2 million, whereas if they're diagnosed earlier and caught early, it's $250,000. So that's a considerable difference. This is one of the cases where the federal government paid for the startup of this test, but then a state is responsible to maintain the test ongoing. We need to pay for the lab equipment, the testing supplies, and the staff to actually conduct those tests. The second test is called CCHD, or critical congenital heart defects. These are heart defects that require surgery within the first year of life. And what we would do then is test for the blood oxygen levels, where we can detect those conditions before they become visible. And what that allows for, again, is quicker follow-up and treatment before the risk of disability and death has increased. Again, the feds paid for the startup for this test, but the state would be responsible for the cost of the technology, the reporting, and the follow-up to maintain those tests ongoing.
Ms. Reed, is that what the Heart Association has been talking to us about? that particular test?
Mr. Chair, I believe this is one of the issues the Heart Association is discussing with you. They have actually having a rally today talking about critical congenital heart disease as one of the important initiatives that they have.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we are hearing, I think it's Representative Fritz's bill on this in the Policy Committee tomorrow.
Mr. Chair and members, this appropriation covers more education and outreach, which is very important, actually, because the effectiveness of this newborn screening program really depends on that partnership between us, the providers who administer the tests, and then the parents who actually need to follow up when there's a presumptive positive. And then if the child is positive, then follow up continuously with the treatment that's required. And so what the education and outreach portion would do is provide new staff to educate parents and providers about changes in the program, create more public awareness about the program and its effect on children's lives, and also to support these efforts and fix the deficit in the fee account. This proposal is supported by an increase in the newborn screening fee. It would go from $106 per specimen to $140, and that's the fee that's charged to hospitals and midwives to get the cards that actually the blood spots are put on. And since that cost is typically passed on to insurers, there is a impact on the medical assistance program, which you see tracked in the DHS budget. So we have the change in the program in ours, and you see that tracking in theirs as well. So I'll move to the next item. That is home health care reform. This is another item that's likely familiar to you. It was contained in a similar proposal was in the governor's budget last year. And while it wasn't in the HHS omnibus bill, we had a direction to come back to you with a recommendation for a fee-based proposal to expand our regulatory program. And so that's what you see here. You see that recommendation to you reflected in this proposal. And what this does is it really protects vulnerable adults and other consumers of home health care by ensuring those settings are safe, protected, and free from abuse and neglect. And what this does is it really sort of overhauls our state regulation of home care, which we've actually been doing since 1987. And home health care, as a reminder, is a kind of a broad range of services. It serves people of all ages in their homes, and it's kind of everything from simple activities of daily living, like bathing, to administering medication or even specialized health care services delivered in the home. And so what this does is it updates the law that we use to regulate this industry. It resets our staffing ratios to match what is really tremendous growth in the industry. We now have about 1,500 providers in the state. That's a 209% increase since 1995 and a 24% increase since 2007. That's tremendous growth that our program just hasn't kept pace with. We have about 9.25 staff total, which in 2011 actually conducted 185 inspections of 108 distinct providers. We also investigated another 331 complaints, of which 95% were substantiated. So as you can see, we do have a large impact, but it's not keeping pace with 1,500 providers in the industry. We also currently have four license types. Some providers need two different licenses to operate in the state, and some of the fee rates for those licenses were set as long as 20 years ago. And so what actually led to this proposal is in 2007, the legislature directed us to create a work group to recommend fixes to these and other issues that the legislature was seeing in the industry and in our regulation. And those recommendations from that work group are also reflected in this proposal. And so what the proposal really does has a few components. First, it'll allow us to inspect every provider within 3 years, so each provider would get an inspection about every 3 years. And for new providers who are entering the market, it would allow us to inspect them within that first year. What we'd actually do is issue them a temporary license, and then we would make sure they get an inspection within that first year. It also increases the application requirements for those entering the industry to make sure that they are prepared to provide safe settings and care. And it also clarifies our statute and allows us to create a new website to make sure the information is very clear. Everyone knows what's expected of them. And we'd also set up an advisory council to continue advising the department over time on changes in the industry in the future. And just wanted to a quick note this is not to be confused with a DHS waiver program that's the home and community-based services. Sometimes this is a point of confusion. We did actually have a group from our department of DHS work very closely together to make sure their proposal this year to create some licensing in that area doesn't conflict with ours. And what they did find is for a small slice, about 140 providers, there was a possibility of needing a licensure by both departments. So there's some language included in the DHS section of the bill that addresses that. And what it does is it directs our department to enforce the standards under the HCBS program. And so they'll only be regulated by us in the short term, and we would be enforcing those standards. And then we'll bring back some language to fix that up in future years to make sure we can get it set permanently.
I would appreciate if you could get me like a one-pager with bullets on it that explains what DHS is doing in this area in terms of licensing and what you are doing, because it's a huge issue in the Department of Human Services, and it's also the major area for fraud. So if you could get me something that shows what the Department of Health is doing in this area and what the Department of Human Services is doing.
Mr. Chairman,
monitoring these people. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to do so.
Okay. And we have... we have a number of students from the Friends School here. I assume that's the group up there. Welcome to the committee.
And up there, the veil up there. Yeah.
They're 7th and 8th graders. And Representative Abler has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, to this topic here. And I'm really happy that the two departments are collaborating. That's a very healthy step, so I'll just make it a very positive statement. Students here are positive statements. Shoot high, work together, and keep our citizens safe. Is there a fee increase for this at all? I see there's some revenue. Is that just more people covered, or is there a fee increase? I have a couple questions.
Mr. Chair, members, there is a fee increase to cover the readjusting of the staffing ratios to match the growth in the industry.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative,
and maybe we can discuss this more offline. I'm keenly interested in this. There's a bunch of fee increases on these providers. I don't know if this is a 245D group or if it's some other ones, but some of these are going to be crushing on some of these folks, and so we really need to be careful about how we're doing this. And I know you need to collect money, and we asked you to come back with a plan about getting more inspectors, and we had some mythical money we did for a little bit that didn't last very long until George Hoffman decided it wasn't tenable to get you some more inspectors. And so I understand the need, but if we can, as this moves forward, there's plenty of time to have some private chats about that. So, but I just understand there's not a lot of capacity in this niche to pay a lot of fees because they've had no increases for quite some time. So thank you.
Okay, Ms. Reed.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll move next to the proposal, the healthcare facilities. I have a different name here, excuse me. Healthcare facility blueprint review. So this actually would charge a fee for the service we provide for reviewing architectural, mechanical, and electrical plans before construction begins. So these are really for healthcare facilities like hospitals, nursing homes, boarding care homes, residential hospices, and outpatient surgical centers. And what we do is we have a group of engineers in our compliance monitoring program that review plans before construction begins. And that allows them to make sure that they're not constructing facilities that won't meet the specialized standards for these kind of facilities and then need to make costly changes in their construction and design later. And it allows them to make sure that they are meeting those state and federal standards to receive reimbursement and to deliver that care. And the kinds of things that this review covers are bedrooms, corridors, kind of construction materials, heating, cooling, ventilation, patient food preparation, those kinds of things that are really special and unique to healthcare facilities. And so right now, we have been covering, this service doesn't have a funding source that supports it. Right now, we've been using part of the regular license fee to cover these costs, but really it would be better to charge a fee that to those folks who are using the service. And so we can make sure it's sustainable going forward. and we provide about an average of 213 reviews per year through this service, and there's slightly less than three staff that do that work.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these new employees, new FTEs, or are these existing FTEs that you just don't pick up anywhere with allocation?
Ms. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, these are existing staff who do provide the service right now, and the challenge is we haven't been collecting a revenue to support that service specifically. We've been kind of subsidizing it with our license fees.
Mr. Chair, and Ms. Reed, I'm not familiar that we do this elsewhere where we would pick up a specific fee. Is there other areas within the Department of Health with restaurant fees, for example, that you would charge back individually? It would seem to me that these kinds of compliance monitoring and checks would be standard with any type of construction of a licensed facility. Do you do this? Does the department typically allocate staff and charge back specific fees for inspections within the Department of Health currently? And if so, where?
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I'm going to start the answer to that, and then I'm going to let someone from the program continue it. I would say, in general, the way the fees are set kind of varies across licensing programs, both within our department and across the state. And so sometimes you'll find a more kind of a la carte model that you use more commonly when different providers choose different services or need different services from us. You also often see a sort of complete model, which we do use often in our department, which is we charge one fee for licensure that kind of covers the range of work that we do. In this case, we're kind of pulling out this one piece to say it doesn't necessarily fit with the regular license fee, because it then would be assessed on everybody, even though not everyone is having physical plant changes that require this kind of review. But I will let someone from the program.
Mr. Chair, I don't think it's necessary to have somebody from the department come down and talk about that, but if you wouldn't mind just having somebody shoot me an email on what the current and proposed, particularly for the construction cost fee increases, would be and how that gets tracked within the department, and if we do that elsewhere or if this is kind of a something different. Thanks.
And Mr. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Reed, in reviewing the facilities, does that include the veterans' homes? I know we have a couple of facilities that are being requested, Bemidji and Brainerd. So would you review them, or is that up to the Department of Veterans Affairs to do that?
Mr. Great. Chair, Representative, I'm getting a nod from the back that says we do that.
Good. Thank you.
Continue.
Mr. Chair, members, I will then move to the mortuary science changes. And this is actually tracking the fiscal impact for a number of more policy changes in this area. And this is an area of regulation that covers funeral establishments, crematories, and morticians. And what this does first is create some separate standards for alkaline hydrolysis, which is a chemical alternative to cremation. And it's currently regulated under our cremation standards in the state. And that's been that way since 2003. But what this would do is actually set up a separate set of regulatory standards for that specific industry. And it really is necessary, because then we can address the unique features, the chemicals and process specific to that, and that'll allow us to protect operators and also the public. And these changes are based on input from a work group of stakeholders, and while we are creating a separate set of standards for them, we're going to continue assessing the same fee they've been paying to be regulated under the crematory statute. So there's actually a net zero fiscal impact, but because we're putting the new fee in law, that needs to be tracked in the governor's budget. And the second change in this area relates to embalming preparatory rooms. And what this actually does is reduce the regulatory requirements on funeral homes. It'll no longer require them to have this on-site embalming room. Instead, they could use a central location and then use their satellite locations for the other services that they provide. It still requires them to meet all the same standards for an embalming room, but they can just do it in that central location if they choose. This allows funeral homes to adjust to a real shift in the industry. There's been a shift towards cremation, which is now 50% the choice by families, compared to 8.5% as recently as 2003. And so the industry is finding they no longer need all those rooms at all the locations to meet the demand.
Ms. Reed, we have a couple questions in mind. First, the cremation and the effect of mercury in the teeth, is that addressed in any of this? Or
Mr. Chair, this
Commissioner.
The alkaline hydrolysis eliminates that kind of problem for this form of cremation, but this legislation does not address the mercury in the traditional cremation process.
And Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the same line of questioning. In the state of Minnesota, 3% of our mercury emissions come from crematoria, and working on the issue of mercury emissions back in 05-06, the problem seemed to be that the dentists didn't want the morticians to be able to remove the teeth with the mercury fillings, and so that seems like an issue that's ripe for the Department of Health to maybe get involved to see if we can get the dental associations and the mortuary sciences folks to come to an agreement about getting the teeth out. It's a little morbid, but morticians do remove pacemakers before they cremate people, and so it doesn't seem like much of a stretch to allow them to remove mercury from teeth. But right now it's my understanding that the dental laws and regulations in the state prevent morticians from doing this. So it's something that if you could figure out a solution that the dentists and the morticians could agree to, we could reduce mercury emissions by 3% or 68 pounds a year.
Ms. Reed, continue.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll turn next to cost recovery for lab testing. This is the second of two proposals, as I mentioned, to stabilize funding for our lab. And this actually provides a cost recovery model for the voluntary testing portion of their work. And what it would do is replace a $25 handling fee that's currently in statute, which is really insufficient to cover the costs of most tests, and can't actually be billed back to third-party insurers. And what it would allow us to do instead is to actually contract with medical providers to perform that diagnostic testing, and also to charge other labs for reference testing. And those contract rates would more accurately reflect the cost to perform each specific test. And what this would do, though, as I mentioned before, is retain that exemption for specimens sent under the mandatory disease reporting law. Again, we don't want any financial disincentive for that work to continue. And this change would allow us to keep pace with commercial laboratories in other states, such as Wisconsin and Iowa, who do this kind of charging. And it will reduce the burden on our general fund to maintain that core infrastructure at our lab. And I'll move then to the Environmental Lab Accreditation Program. This item is a policy change, actually, to that program that we have, which ensures that environmental labs around the state have the policies, procedures, equipment, and practices to produce reliable data. And this is really important because it's the data from these labs that are used for enforcement actions related to the environment. And so we run the whole program right now, and what this would do is allow us to allow for contracting out of one portion, the portion related to assessments or kind of inspections of the labs. We would continue doing all the other components, which includes oversight of the program, administration of the program, assessment review, proficiency testing, monitoring, corrective actions, and training. And what we do is actually create a list of independent assessors that we've deemed qualified to do this work, and then labs would contract directly with those assessors. And so in order to reflect that they would be contracting directly with them and paying them directly, we'll reduce our fees and staffing. The fees would go down by about 40%, and we'd reduce the staffing by about one full-time equivalent. And just as a note, we do accredit about 95 labs. 25 of them are out of state. Six of those we accredit directly, or 19 we actually accept accreditation through another similar body. The next item is protecting groundwater from geothermal heat system installation. And this really closes a loophole in our existing regulation of heat exchanger systems. And currently our regulation applies to holes that are dug straight into the ground, but we're finding more and more the holes for these systems are being dug at an angle. And because the word vertical is in our statute, we can't apply our regulation to those system installations. And it's really important because they have the same possibility of endangering our drinking water, and because these holes can be anywhere from 10 to 100 feet into the ground. And so our oversight really protects groundwater by ensuring that the borings, the holes, are done by licensed and trained installers, that they are constructed with appropriate materials and methods, that they're properly grouted, and that they also use a low toxicity form of the fluids that are used for the heat transfer. And all this would do is extend those license fees that we currently charge to vertical to those drilling the angled holes. And we would need, because of the additional volume, some additional staffing and support to do that, the inspections and the licensing work.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has come up a couple of years, I think. The Senate supported it, the House didn't before. And I met a guy who actually does this. The Bohr geothermal heat exchanger sounds like a kind of a, you know, a disinterested worker guy, you know. bored. Anyway. So there was this heading, and then they're like, what the heck is this? And so this guy shows up who does this. And there's some controversy, just, you know. So if we can, if you decide you like the idea, I think we should have some testimony so somebody can come tell us about the department's good intention. There's another side to the story about some nuance, which I'm not conversant on, but just to point out that it might be worth a little discussion, or if we can find those people who do this to tell us why this is a good or not a good idea.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll move to the last item, which is a lead enforcement lead enforcement penalty. This actually just tracks a change in the lead enforcement penalty that we have in law, and we need to increase it by, at direction of the federal government, to the EPA standard of 5,000 per violation per day, with some limitations on the total. We don't actually anticipate using it, but we do need to make this change in law to retain the authority to enforce state and federal standards in the state. And so if we aren't able to do this and comply with the federal directive, they will likely take back the regulation of lead enforcement in the state. And if it's taken back by them, it would actually be administered out of their closest office in Chicago. And we don't feel that that provides the same kind of on-the-ground service to the state in this area that we can provide through our department. And this is also really important because the authorization that we have is used to leverage about $8 to $15 million per year of federal money for lead hazard reduction and healthy homes activities, both in the local and some other state programs. So they're kind of relying on us to maintain our authorization to make sure they can get those funds. And that those funds include about $300,000 annually for our department. So this is an important change. And just for some background, the work that we do is actually kind of inspect the lead abatement in child-occupied facilities, educate abatement workers and companies, and training course providers to make sure folks know how to do this work properly. And then you'll also see in your packet, even though I'm not going to cover them today, a number of pages related to those clean water proposals that I mentioned. Those are covered, I believe, by the legacy and perhaps the environmental committee in this body. And then there's also just an item related to rent savings. I mentioned that before. Many of you may have been to our facility up at Snelling Office Park off of Snelling, and we are in the process of closing that facility. We've moved staff from there to existing space that we already have in our two other metro facilities, and then also moved the remaining services to smaller or less expensive space. So we do have a small amount of savings that accrues to the general fund from that. And then, although I won't cover it today, you will note if you look through the governor's document, they also track for information purposes in our area an appropriation made to the PCA in the Environment Committee that relates to some work that we do. So I think with that,
we're open to
that's all of our questions. We're open to any questions, or all of our discussion. We're open to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was didn't see a spreadsheet, so I made it my own little spreadsheet. And the tally I came up with was your favorite topic, Mr. Chair, $40 million, the healthcare access fund for the SHIP program, about $900,000 in the general fund, $89,000 in savings in state special revenue funds, and $5.77 million in the clean water thing. Just for your interest's sake, I have a little time in my hands. You know, I had a strong interest in autism in the Somali community last year, and I pushed you guys, I thought, pretty hard about coming with some kind of plan about how you might investigate this group and maybe have a clue about where autism comes from, especially with this laboratory of, high-risk individuals we have, which have, I think, 1 in 27 incidents of autism. And I don't see any mention of that here. Can you just give me a hint on what you're thinking about that? I'm trying to be polite, but I didn't sleep much last night, and I'm kind of irritated about not seeing something here with this. I think it's an opportunity, so I'll stop talking before I... But I'm just, can you give me what you're thinking and where your leadership is going to be on this topic?
And Commissioner, and also, if you know what Human Services is doing in the area of autism.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, autism is an issue that has been front burner on many people's minds, and we've been working collaboratively with the Department of Human Services to find some way to get the services to the people with autism. We've also been working with the university to do a study. We've got grant funding coming in to look at the epidemiology of it and look at the prevalence. We wanted to get a good prevalence study of autism in the community before we move on to, you know, trying to find some other approaches to work on the cause. We figure trying to find the cause, we really need to work with the university to try what research is absolutely needed to actually come up with those causes. We don't believe that is sort of within the realm of what we can do with the expertise we have, but it is something we can certainly partner with the university and other researchers like the NIH to come up with an approach. Looking for causes. We've also started looking at the epidemiology of autism to see if we can find some ways to focus our efforts in a little bit more effective way. This is a huge issue that we don't have any direct appropriation for this at this time, but we're doing a lot of background work, and we do have a report that's coming from all the work that we're doing that will be available in 2014 on what we found at this point in time.
Mr. Chair, I'll just take a breath. You have a really good department, Commissioner. You're known for discovering salmonella in places that nobody found it and discovering things. And it just strikes me philosophically that the state's largest epidemiological venue of national stature would be leading the way on this, since we have such a concentration of Somalis. And I was just wishing there was a page that said we're working on it, it's on our mind, and trying to be polite, I felt like I've been pushing you all along the way on here to a place you're almost disinterested in going, and relying on the U, and they're also prestigious and important. But I think it's your job, we're the policymakers, in my opinion, it's your job to lead on this, and to take the bull by the horns and be the lead agency and say, I'd like to see a $2 million bit of money. Or something where you're going to hire a researcher of your own and to push the U and to, you know, because it's always two more years, and the problem remains, and here's just a golden opportunity. So I'm not the chair anymore, so I have a little less leverage than I had before, but if I was writing the bill, I would have put something in there this year, even counting the study coming back. So if that's as polite as I know your high interest and your desire, and so sometimes a little push from a friend can push good desire to more action. So I hope I said it politely, but it's on my mind, and so I think it's a big problem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, you know, we have been thinking about autism. We have been thinking about the best approaches. I do think that, as you identify, an epidemiological study hasn't really been done yet on autism, looking at all of the factors that go into that condition, which is devastating to families and individuals. We have started some activity within our epidemiological expertise to begin that look and have the partners. And this is going to, but it is going to be something that we're going to have to do in partnership. It's a huge problem, multifactorial, that is going to take a lot of work from a lot of agencies. And I certainly understand your pressure and feel your pressure that we will continue to look at this maybe with a little bit more vigor and a little bit more visibility than we've had in the past. So thank you very much.
And Commissioner, if you could have somebody look up how much money and what the National Institutes of Health is doing in this area. Certainly we have a very large Somali population, but I'm not sure we're all set up to do the basic science of determining the real cause. But it would be interesting to know how much the NIH is, how much money and how much time they're putting into this thing. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
We have a question from Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Abler, for raising this. And yeah, appreciate that you're keeping this on the radar screen. And actually, when we were going through the budget request and the cancer surveillance budget request was mentioned, I was wondering whether that system would lend itself to other kinds of issues as well as cancer. I don't know what the technical pieces of that are, but autism surveillance is something we talk about, and I don't know, or other disease surveillance, and I don't know if the systems would be really different, or are we talking about two completely different things there, or is it that we're building a IT structure that could be used more expansively? I know cancer's pretty expansive by itself, but just wondering about how that works.
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, a lot of basic research needs to be done on autism. We are really working with the university to try to find the prevalence, the true prevalence. Right now, we don't know the prevalence of autism in various communities. We know the communities and the individuals who are receiving services, but we don't know what the underlying prevalence is. So to do a surveillance, you need to know what are the indicators that you would have. And the knowledge about autism and the diagnosis and the criteria are evolving, so we need to find those things out first. So I think a lot of basic research, basic understanding of this condition needs to be learned before we can set up a best surveillance system. We're looking at some of the surveillance systems that have been put up in other states to see if we can learn from them in terms of what the prevalence is and what we should be doing here. And those will be parts of what we will be looking at to develop our approach to that.
Representative Norton, and we have to move on to Doug Berg and let him finish up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I'm not going to talk about autism, but I'm going to talk about something broader, and that is I'm pleased to see many of the items in your budget, and as I mentioned, another one of my pet projects earlier. But one of the things that you haven't talked about much here, although I think many of your actions will address it, which is health disparities. And, you know, we were talking about the autism community, but we know throughout the state we have disparities in health care, and often it's the effects have to do with socioeconomic status and income levels. And I do think with some of the issues that you've addressed here, that might get at some of that, whether we're talking about obesity or lead or clean water. But I guess I'm just appreciative that we work on this, even though we didn't call it a healthcare disparity issue. It is something we need to address in the state. We don't talk about it in committee quite as often as I think maybe we should. And sometimes our policies, like a tobacco tax, which we worry a little bit about, at least some folks on my side of the aisle talk about it as a regressive tax. However, it does affect some populations more than others. The health impact affects some populations more than others, and it is a healthcare disparity issue. And so while the tax may be a burden financially, the results will impact that population in a way that would be very helpful to close the gap in the disparity as well. So, again, I'm just thanking you for your efforts here, and pointing out that, you know, we do have significant health care disparities in this state, and public health is often the place we address those. And so thank you for your efforts, and I appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, yes, the health disparities are a huge issue in the state. Our health rankings are going to be going down because of our lack of addressing the health disparities. We become an increasingly diverse state. If we don't address those disparities, I think our overall rankings will go down and our health status will go down. So we are addressing those and actually making it a part of all of the programs that we have throughout the department. In particular, we're going to be adding health disparities as one of the foci of the SHIP program so that we can actually address those kinds of disparities throughout the state. We're looking at our how we collect information, certainly making sure that all of our data collected so that we can actually look at the impact of disparities and how we might address that. And certainly through our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health and our grants to eliminating health disparities, we continue to focus on that as a major focus of what we're doing, and again look for partnerships with lots of other individuals. The tobacco issue is certainly a big one, and I'm glad that the governor would put into the budget the 94-cent tax, and we've certainly heard from communities that they see the disproportionate impact that tobacco has on their communities, and communities throughout the state, low-income communities and populations of color are supportive of that tax because they see the impact it has on their communities.
Thank you, Commissioner, and Ms. Reed, and now we'll move on to Doug Berg.
Mr. Chairman and members, there's just two other small governor's recommendations that followed our smaller agencies, and I'll just run through them very briefly. You've got in your packets the fact sheets, the budget sheets for each of them, the first of which is the Minnesota State Council on Disability. The governor's recommending a $90,000 a year increase in general fund appropriation for the Council on Disabilities to add one FTE dealing with coordinated emergency preparedness training for issues surrounding persons with disabilities. The base of the council is $1,048,000 biennially, and again, this is $90,000 a year, $180,000 increase. The other is at the office of the ombudsperson for families. It's also a staffing position. The governor's recommending $68,000 in 2014 and $69,000 in 2015 to add back an office manager position for that organization. Their general fund budget is $530,000 a biennium, and those are the only other governor's recommendations outside of the health department and the DHS.
Any questions? Well, I don't see anything, and if there's anybody from the Department of Health, when in the SHIP program, you're going to see a little amendment that says in healthy behaviors, you should look at encouraging people to get 8 hours of sleep, particularly in the legislature. So, with that, the meeting is adjourned.